Should we make a start then?
Yes.
Actually, before we make a start, what are we actually talking about today? Are we talking about the works of Steve Stewart Williams, or are we talking about the nature-nurture debate?
Well,
I'm not quite sure.
Well, both. I'll be saying things based on the fact that I've been reading this book, but I don't want it to just be a review of the book with you listening. I think it's in the nature of the subject matter that it provokes thoughts from just about everybody who hears it, and that would definitely include you. So any thoughts you have over what gets said or what you already think about these matters are entirely relevant as far as I'm concerned.
Right, okay. That's a pretty good start, actually. I think we might keep that in. Shall we do the formalities?
Yes.
What is it? It's Wednesday,
May the 5th.
5th of May, yes. 2021. Yes. And
yep.
I'm Patrick Crozier.
And I'm Brian Micklethwaite.
And, yes, well, as we said earlier, we're talking about nature versus nurture, I think, essentially, but it's what we're talking about.
Well, it's
illuminated
one of the big
by.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, there are a few other things, aren't there?
This book. Perhaps I should say a bit about the book.
It's,
It was published quite recently. The first version of it came out in 2018, and then there was a revised version in 2020. So it's recent. But it's caused quite a stir. It's rather orthodox in the sense that it summarizes the views of a whole group of scientists in a way that most of them seem to have found pretty satisfactory. And it's one of these books which alludes to arguments that the author himself doesn't agree with, but which he does his best to describe fairly, including debates amongst evolutionary psychologists. It's about evolutionary psychology. That is to say, the claim that it is not only our bodies that evolved, but also our mental habits.
Or what I would regard as the blindingly obvious.
Well, he deals with this in the book. He makes jokes about how only a social scientist could doubt this, or it takes an academic not to realise that this is not just true but obvious, and so on.
We've made similar jokes over the years about only academics could think stupid
could
things.
Could think that.
Yes.
And he says that sort of thing. And I think one of the important things about this book is that he clearly understands how he's treading on the toes of the woke fraternity, and he's entirely ready for any attacks they may launch against him. He makes it very clear that he...
When you say that, you mean he's ready in terms of intellectual attacks he might receive?
How he'd handle it on Twitter. He has a Twitter feed, for example, which I'm very fond of consulting regularly, and I don't know how much the woke people have tried to do him down, but I'm confident that if they did seriously try, they would fail, because basically he's ready for them.
Well,
that makes it. If the book is as widely well received as I think is the case, that means that a whole generation of students are reading it, and not just students of evolutionary psychology, because it's very accessible. Otherwise, I would not be reading it myself. So it is a textbook. Oh, yes, okay. But like the best textbooks, it's more than that.
Right. So something that could be read by normal people
Right, okay. Well, it's to be read by students at the early stages of their studies, and that basically means intelligent laymen. You know, even if you don't want to go any further, you may at least want to read this.
I mean, I'm just trying to think of books that laymen might have read that I read at university.
Well, I was thinking the obvious comparison is Dawkins's The Selfish Gene. But one of the comparisons to make is that The Selfish Gene advanced a very particular thesis that was controversial and did so in a very accessible way. This book is less controversial, I think it's fair to say. It is controversial, but less so. He's trying to summarize an entire field. He's basically a teacher, an academic in, I think, Malaysia, the University of Malaysia.
Yeah.
And
or is it University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus or something like that?
Yes, something like that, yes. He's And it's published by the Cambridge University Press, so it's not some out of the way publisher. It's right there in the heart of things.
You wonder how this came about. I mean, the impression I get is that universities are so woke that they, it might be as well be published by the KGB or something. I mean, it's just so unlikely.
Maybe that universities are not quite as woke as that. I mean, I have conversations with Tim Evans, who's a professor at Middlesex University, and he assures me that the woke people are pretty much of a sideshow. That's what he says. And that the similar things apply to other British universities. He makes quite a distinction between Britain and America. But something similar may even apply in America, where the whole woke thing has been greatly exaggerated. But clearly they have some scalps to show for their activities. But I don't think Steve Stewart Williams is going to be one of them. It could well be that in Malaysia they're more scornful about this sort of nonsense than we are in the Anglo-Saxon world. It wouldn't surprise me.
I'm sure they are. Because I think wokeism, has it gone beyond the sort of, North American and Western Europe? I'm not even sure it's that strong in parts of Western Europe, actually, for that matter.
Yeah, I agree. Well, the particular stuff he says.
I was just going to say maybe when he. I mean, I'm sure. I'm pretty convinced he'll come under attack at some point. But I suspect when he does, we'll find out which part of University of Nottingham or Malaysia campus matters is the important one for his job description.
Yes.
So we have that one to look out for. But
It'll be interesting to see if it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not absolutely up on his confrontational biography, so to speak, and they may already have tried it. But if so, it wouldn't surprise me if he just said, "Oh, fuck off, a lot of you, and you're idiots, and I'm carrying on saying what I'm saying, and I don't apologise for it at all." And if you do that, they haven't got much on you. That the big weapon the woke people use is they expel you from the left-wing tribe. Well, Steve Stewart Williams is not a member in the first place. The evolutionary psychologists have just discovered too many things which go against leftist orthodoxy.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to stop the left. I don't think they're that bothered about the facts.
Well, they're bothered about how other people feel about the facts. They're bullies, is what I'm saying. And bullies smell weakness, and they won't smell it in this guy. That's the point I'm making.
Mm.
To proceed a bit, directly related to what we've been talking about, the big part of the book that relates directly on current wokeness is the stuff he says about sex differences in all animals, and of course humans are animals. And he asserts with great confidence that the evidence is overwhelming that not only did our bodies evolve and become what they are as a result of evolution, but so too do our minds. And the way that human females and males differ from each other is not just a physical thing, it's also the way they think and the way they feel. It's not as pronounced as it is in many other species. And, of course, like all scrupulous observers of these things, he points out that there's huge overlap. There are lots of women who are taller than lots of men, and lots of women who are better at maths than lots of men, and so on and so on and so on. But the averages are very definitely there, and distinct and different. And if you deny that, you're just a fool, as far as he doesn't quite say it as brutally as that, but that is the clear implication of the way he presents this.
I mean, the thing is, I don't know about you, but to me, this has been obvious for 30-odd years.
Yes.
And I have always been... Well, initially I was amazed people just didn't point this out. This is all due to evolution and just, tough shit, really, if you believe in equality. Mm. Is that your feeling?
It is.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly... This is not telling... This book is a rather odd experience, because on the one hand, I was very interested in it, but on the other hand, I didn't disagree with a word of it. It was more a case of the book expressing my own beliefs for me better than I could myself.
Yeah. That's nice.
It is. Well, it's nice in a particular sort of way. I mean, you don't want to read books like that all the time. You want to read books telling you things you didn't know or things you thought wrongly. You know, you want to be challenged. But in this case, there's very little in it that in a big sense, that I didn't know. There are lots and lots of little details, though. So it was continuously informative. The sex differences thing is also it's the kind of book that different people will react to in very different ways. So I, because of the sort of political arguing you and I do, was very struck by the sex difference writings in this book. But because of my own interests, I was also very intrigued by what he said about cultural evolution, and in particular the way that designs develop over time. I'm very interested in design and modernist design in particular.
Now, we're going to talk about Britain fishing boats, I think, aren't we?
Yes, we are. There's a bit on my blog which is... Forgive me, I'm coughing a bit. And that actually leads me on to my third point, which is, you know how people say there are no atheists in foxholes? Well, yeah. In recent months, I've been in a modified and peaceful version of a foxhole because I've been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. And in a slightly less extreme form to that on a battlefield, I am now staring death in the face, certainly much more closely than I have done in the past. And I remember being curious when I was younger, would the experience of approaching death change my beliefs? Would I become religious? Well, no, I haven't. But what I have done is become more interested in questions like, what does life mean? What are the things that matter? What are the things that don't matter? Those sorts of questions have arisen. And I found this book very interesting from that point of view, because it expresses my, insofar as I have deep beliefs about anything, these are those beliefs.
I thought you were going to say something that it somehow shed light on you know, the meaning of life. Was that?
Well, it does, but also part of the meaning of life is, what sort of creature is a human being? You know, what kind of person am I? Why are things the way they are? That's the sort of question I'm interested in. And this book got me thinking in a way which I found applicable to situations which it hadn't occurred to me it would be. I'll give you an example that I'm jumping ahead of what I had in mind to say, but this is sort of point number three. You know, we've got the woke thing, the way he contradicts that. We've got the evolution of culture and design and all that. And now I'm on to part three of what interested me about this book, which is the meaning of life. You know, I recently had a conversation with a friend of mine who does work doing sort of coaching for businesses, where she role plays to get them to handle the circumstances of their job better and to interact more politely, but at the same time effectively, with colleagues and subordinates. And in the course of doing this, one of the people she was involving in this, it was coaching, became venomously hostile to her because of something she said. And it was pretty clear even at the time that it was probably his problem rather than hers. There was something going on in his life which had bent him out of shape. Nevertheless, she was very upset by this episode. I mean, really upset, sort of 3 days of loss of sleep and fretting about what effect it would have on her job, but just a sort of basic fear of, ooh, you know, that was terrible. And not only that, but her whole predicament was made worse by the feeling that she was overreacting in an irrational manner to what had happened. And that only made it worse, the feeling that she was doing that. And I've heard myself say, as you do when you think of things for the first time almost, that she needn't beat herself up for being, in quotes, irrational about this circumstance, because although this man's hostility now probably doesn't mean anything, we are descended from people who lived in much smaller groups than we live in now, much more concentrated little societies, where individual hostility was a very, very big deal and could cost you your life, in the same sort of way that that the wrong kind of snake or the wrong kind of insect could kill you. And so it is perfectly reasonable for all humans to be, in quotation marks, irrationally frightened of snakes, creepy crawlies, and intense hostility from any other human being, because you could literally die because of that. I mean, we're talking about societies which, in the olden evolutionary times, during which humans have spent most of their history living in, the murder rate was much higher than it is now.
Is that something that Steve Stewart Williams says? I know Steve...
No, he doesn't. I got this from Matt Ridley, who was writing about the murder rate and about cities and state governments and all that sort of stuff, and trying to knock the noble savage idea back into its...
Well, it's certainly interesting. I don't know if this helps, but it's perhaps the source of this is that is when they're finding bodies in bogs in Ireland, they've all been murdered.
Yes.
As far as they
can
tell.
They are.
They've all been murdered. Mm. Oh, the vast majority, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the murder rate was... And in similar societies now in out-of-the-way spots in the world, it seems that the murder rate is much higher. So in other words, for humans to associate intense human hostility from any other human with very, very bad news may not be rational in our world to be so frightened of it, but it is extremely rational from the evolutionary point of view. And I was able at least to soften the blow for this friend of mine by saying that. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. There's also an implication there, isn't it, that we humans, we cavemen, are not actually particularly well adjusted to the world in which we live.
Yes. That's a point that is made much of in this book, that there are lots and lots of mismatches between what our nature is and what our tastes are and our most pleasurable experiences and what this does to us in the world we now live in. I mean, a classic example is our enormous fondness for sweetness to eat. This evolved in a world where if you came across any sweetness, gobble it up now because you're not going to get another chance for a few months. But now, of course, we are constantly supplied with it.
And it rots your teeth and makes you fat, so, yeah.
That's right, that's right. I mean, obesity is not exactly a problem they had on the ancient plains of Africa or wherever it is we did our evolving, but it is now. And so the mismatch between human nature as it has evolved and human nature as it now needs to be is a big theme in this book.
Does he have any answers?
Well, not really. I mean, it's once you've defined the problem, you at least know what you're up against, and you're able to help the people who are suffering from these effects in a way that is less abusive. You know, you're not going to say, "Oh, stop eating, you fat bastard," if you know that you are telling a human being to do something that is against human nature, you know?
Yeah.
You'll mind your manners if you've thought about it the way that the evolutionary psychologists do.
But it strikes me that education is a far more time-consuming, expensive thing to do than dealing with instincts. I mean, education in terms of counteracting your instincts, your caveman instincts, is a difficult thing to do.
Yes, yes.
And I wonder how far it would
ever... But one obvious first step, maybe not the only obvious one, but one obvious first step is simply name the beast you're up against. Name the dragon you're trying to slay, which is our instincts. You know, just get it out there in the open. We are evolved to have a great fondness for sweet foods.
He doesn't suggest, for instance, that natural selection would play a part here in the...
Well, this I think is one of the most interesting aspects of this book, which is because he writes about the idea that something like a fondness for sweet things or a fondness for pornography, for example, which is an obvious byproduct of our reproductive urges, but which on the face of it doesn't appear to contribute very much to our ongoing evolutionary success, put it that way. But he then speculates later in connection with the what he says about human culture. He says something I've long believed. Again, it's what you said, that he's saying things I've already worked out for myself, that humans are even now evolving into the culture that humans have created. And this, if that's happening now, it's not the first time. I mean, a good example of this is the phenomenon of lactose tolerance. Most of us have heard of the phrase lactose intolerant, but that used to be the default setting for all humans. But then when humans started domesticating animals, it became enormously helpful for humans to be able to drink milk, not non-human milk, cow's milk.
And I'm a bit puzzled here, because if it's all of them, then surely none of them are going to be able to...
Well, very few,
right, okay, a few
chance variations could handle milk.
So they got fed and the others didn't, yes, and they prospered, yes, and had more children. Right, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and yeah, by the way, we've skated over one of the more important facts at the beginning of the book, which is that the object of evolution is the gene, not the human being, or for that matter, the group of human beings or the family of human beings. It's the gene itself, which is perfectly replicable. And genes, well, as Dawkins said, they behave as if they're totally selfish. But that has the implication, as Dawkins explained, that humans are anything but selfish in their entirety anyway. I mean, clearly we're rather selfish in lots of ways, but we are also very unselfish in lots of ways. And it's because the genes themselves are so selfish.
I'm sorry, bro. I'm actually rather unfamiliar with Dawkins' book.
Oh,
can you give a really brief summary?
Brief summary is that when Darwin proclaimed the idea of evolution itself, this was followed by about half a century or more of uncertainty about exactly what was evolving. What exactly is the mechanism for all this? There was some work done about, tendencies and genetic tendencies and things like red hair and a particular shape of nose or something, so that people began to get the idea that there were characteristics that were somehow floating about in the human population. But it was only after the Second World War, with the work of Watson and Crick, that the process of evolution was located as being in our DNA. And Dawkins starts with that and derives from that work the important fact that it's not human beings who are selfish. It is genes, the actual genes themselves, of which we have, I don't know, whatever it is, lots and lots and lots of them. And it's these genes that are propagating themselves. And it's almost, and evolutionary scientists are fond of saying that a bear is the way that the genes in a bear propagate themselves. A human is a machine for perpetuating and spreading human genes, rather than the other way round.
Yes,
we are at the mercy of our genes.
Yes, know your boss. Right, okay.
Yeah, and it's a bit like, I mean, the parallel with God is pretty striking. God organizes everything, decides everything, allows whatever he allows and forbids whatever he forbids and intervenes when he feels like it. Well, genes perform a similar function in the mental universe of the evolutionist, so to speak, which I would call myself, you know, going to the meaning of life bit. It's a whole structure, right, of belief about why things are as they are.
Right. I'm trying to remember what yeah, I've asked you to do that summary. Now what was the point about Dawkins?
Dawkins, well, the selfish gene is basically it's a long time since I've read it, so I'm probably not the best person to tell you what it says, but the gist of it is...
Well, the gist is that the genes control us, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Right, okay, I got that.
I'm just
trying to think why that came into the conversation, that's the only thing.
Well, it came into it because it was a very big book in its time, and it still is. People still read that book, I'm sure. And I think it's reasonable to compare this book by Steve Stewart Williams with that earlier book.
Uh-huh.
And even if it turns out not to be as impactful in the longer term, it's still worth comparing the two books because the comparison is illuminating. I mean, it, as I say, this book is more orthodox. It's less revolutionary. Now, that he hasn't started any arguments the way Dawkins does and did, but he's settled, he's described lots of arguments. I don't think Dawkins was writing a textbook in quite the same way that Steve Stewart Williams is. And going back to this business of the way that humans evolve into culture, another reaction I've had to this book, because of my own personal interests, and my point about saying that is that I think lots of other people would read this book, and if asked to talk about it the way I'm talking about it now, they would say completely different things. They would talk about how he said something about some subject that happens to be of great interest to them, but not to me. But one of the subjects that interests me a lot is music. Every Saturday I listen to Record Review and hear them talking about what's the best version of, you know, Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony or whatever.
I think we should point out to anyone who's listening who isn't familiar with this that your, at least one of your walls in your flat is completely taken over by
covered
CDs.
Classical CDs, exactly. Yeah. Yes. And one of the things that Steven Pinker, the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, that book, has said is that music is oral cheesecake. By that he means it is purely the consequence of what we're like, but it's not useful. You know, I think you 5 minutes ago you were asking, you know, are there things that are valuable? I mean, the our taste for sweet food is—he's deliberately evoking that when he calls it cheesecake. And of course, lots of musical people have got very exercised about this because they've been wanting to believe that music is better than that. It's more useful than that. It's more significant. It's done more to make humans human and to help them to win their struggles. But what's ironic and quite funny about these articles I've been reading about, whether Pinker's right, basically, is that they don't mention the most obvious example, and that is battle hymns, military singing. I suppose they find that just too distressing to think about.
Well, in that context, it does matter.
Well, of course it does, yes. Because it's central to evolution. I mean, if it's true that battles are central to evolution. If an entire culture gets wiped out by its enemies, that's an evolutionary event.
Yes.
And the wiping out of entire cultures, by which I just mean, you know, a few hundred people who come across another gang of people who are maybe a couple of thousand, and the guys who are a couple of thousand just murder the lot of them, maybe, or they steal their women and sow the ground with salt or whatever. But whatever happens, it's a genetic event. It's an evolutionary event. Some genes do much, much better than others. So therefore, any process which helps an army fight better is an evolutionary advantage. And being the Pacific orthodoxists that most academics are, they don't mention the best example of music in evolutionary history, which is the battle hymn. I don't need to persuade you of this because I don't have to persuade you of the importance of battles. We spend about half our podcast talking about battles.
Of course, one thing about 20th century battle is you can't have music in it.
Well, let me give you an example of you being a bit wrong. One of my least favourite war movies is a thing called The Battle of the Bulge, because it raped the facts. You know, it turned a huge battle into a piffling little engagement with about a half a dozen tanks. A stupid film. But there was one scene in it which struck me as very impressive, and that was the scene where this blonde beast of a tank commander, played by Robert Shaw, confronted a bunch of beginner tank commanders, very young, very inexperienced. And he looked at them and he basically said to them, "You haven't got what it takes." And their response wasn't to discuss the point with him. Their response was to start singing the Horst Wessel song. One of them started singing and then they all joined in. And that was how they persuaded Robert Shaw that they were made of the right stuff to be tank commanders. And it actually made them more effective tank commanders. You know,
well, it did in the movie.
In the movie. And it's not an unrealistic idea, is it? That by singing a song before a battle, you fight the battle better.
Yes, I could easily believe that.
So there's a...
Maybe that's what music does. It's just... Yeah, maybe that's the role of music, in all music.
Well, it's one of the roles of music, to put it mildly. I mean, being a classical music follower, I am very struck by how important military music is in the bigger picture. You know, the presence of drums and trumpets, as well as the more indoor politenesses of the violin and the viola and so on. It's a very big part of musical history. It's been eclipsed in our time. Classical musicians, I mean, the proportion of them who regard CND as obviously right and war as obviously wrong in all circumstances, not something they want to be attached to, it's almost embarrassing how completely that point of view has taken over. But only as recently as the Second World War, those of us who know a bit about that war will remember that music played its part. You know, the way that the BBC used the opening bars of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony to fight the war.
Was it Kenneth Clark who turned over the National Gallery for lunchtime concerts?
Well,
I'll check on that
thing.
One. I think it is. But
yeah, I think it was. But that's another point about music, which is that it has a huge role in religion. And religion has a huge role in the viability or lack of it of societies. Otherwise, religion itself wouldn't have evolved.
I mean, I have heard it said it has a sort of direct line to the emotions. It doesn't go through any interpretation with music. So, although it still seems odd, doesn't it? I mean, you can see the usefulness of it, but why it should be useful is perhaps difficult.
Well, I'm now going beyond Steve Stewart Williams. He doesn't spend a lot of time arguing the toss about drums and trumpets in Haydn symphonies or something. In fact, I don't think Haydn gets any mentions at all. But in fact, I know he doesn't. But what I'm doing is applying the sort of model of how the world works to matters that are of particular interest to me. And I think that will probably be the reaction of most people reading this book.
Yeah. I wonder if Steve Stewart Williams listens to music.
Less than I do is the definite feeling I get.
Well,
not least because he's a lot busier teaching his students than I'm busy doing anything by comparison. But I do think that music is a... I mean, where did our taste for music come from, evolutionarily speaking, in the first place? It would appear to have been something to do with the way that we learn how to detect emotion in the voices of others and how other people feel about us. I mean, we've covered that with the
example you're giving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That matters to us a lot as a species. We're very sociable. We depend a lot on the opinion of others that others hold of us and how they feel about us. From this small idea that certain sounds communicate feelings, onto this, the vast edifice of music has been erected.
It's actually quite extraordinary when you think that these sounds are produced on instruments which had to be invented.
Yes. But I mean, to give you an example of how the noises made by your fellow creatures clearly influence your musical tastes, this may seem irrelevant, but I think it isn't. I did a posting the other day on my personal blog about a bunch of cows that were being entertained by a group of cellists from the local music school. This was in Denmark. And the cows clearly liked this music. Well, I don't think it's too fanciful to suggest that the noise made by a cello bears a distinctive resemblance to the noise made by a cow.
Sort of low down, you mean?
Yes, mooing and, you know, and it's a noise they particularly like. I don't think that's far-fetched as a way of thinking about what's going on there. And something similar has happened with humans.
Yeah, well, actually, and much more advanced as well, I guess.
Well, I think probably because our language is so much more varied and the kinds of emotions we're able to communicate when we speak are so different and there's so many of them, well, you've got a whole orchestra of feelings and atmospheres that can be created with sound. And so there, this huge... I mean, music plays a huge part in the life of millions and millions of people nowadays, doesn't it? Think of those commuters who they sit in their trains with wires attached to their ears, and that those wires are what's making life tolerable for them.
Well, I think it was a point I was making in a conversation we had before this one, was that, to the best of my knowledge, you know, I look at my body and most of it seems to be useful. There doesn't seem to be much waste in it. And I apply the same to my brain.
Yes.
There's probably not a lot of waste there. If we have developed a liking for music, it's there for a reason.
Well, that's not quite right. What we've developed is the raw materials of our liking for music, the dispositions that cause us to like music, because it enables us to interpret emotions when they're told to us, to understand how our children are feeling, or, you know, whatever it is. But the love of music itself...
Sorry, Brian, is that your theory or is that someone else's theory?
No, this is the argument I'm describing that's going on amongst Pinker and the music critics,
right,
and
right.
Steve Stewart William. He rather sides with Pinker in this, but I think it's more complicated than that. At one point, Steve Stewart William says that some propensity of human beings either is a byproduct or it is evolutionarily relevant. I think that's an oversimplification, because I think what has happened with music is that it began as a byproduct, but very quickly humans responded to the existence of this byproduct by making it something useful. Hence, religious singing and military singing, which are very useful for binding the tribe together and making it more effective in contest with other tribes, which is the heart and soul of evolution. Or one of the things that's going on in evolution. I mean, let's be clear, there are other things. There's competition, is that lung cancer cutting in? One of the things that creatures do is compete with each other. I mean, that old joke about how if a bunch of zebras are running away from a lion, do they have to be as fast as the lion? No, they just have to be not the slowest zebra. And therefore, there's a basic sense in which they're competing with zebras rather than with lions. So there's plenty of human competition going on at the individual level. But my point is, and I think if I understand it correctly, Steve Stewart Williams agrees, there is such a thing as group competition. That's been controversial in the discussions that Stewart Williams and his mates all have amongst themselves about how evolution happens. Personally, I think group evolution is very real. Maybe not as frequent as individual competition.
Sorry, group evolution? What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is the kind of evolution that happens when an entire tribe of people gets wiped out.
Oh, yes. I see what you mean. Or decimated, perhaps. Would that also...
Or just conquered and it... swallowed up in a bigger culture. Yes, that too.
I was going to ask, I don't know if anyone's thought about this, but why would there... I mean, you know, Islamic music is very different to Western music. Chinese music is different to Western music. Why?
Oh, yes.
Anyone thought about that?
Oh, yes. People have thought about exactly that. What the sort of answer they give is to say that the love of music seems to be universal, but the form this takes in any particular culture is very distinct and recognisably different. And after all, that's the point of a battle song, isn't it? You're different from those other bastards. You're going to kill them. They're not the same as us.
Amusingly, of course, in the First World War, the British and the Germans had the same national anthem.
Anyway, well, yes. I mean, European wars are a bit different from the sort of... cultural competitions I'm talking about, but even there you get
and in the Second World War, both sides played Lily Marleen.
Yes,
that seems to
yes.
be a favourite.
Well,
song.
Both played Beethoven. Hitler was obsessed with Bruckner, I think.
I can imagine. I mean, we're almost saying that war is a competition between different forms of music.
I mean, you could say that. I mean, almost. Let me be clear. I am obsessed with music of a very particular sort, and I've studied the history of it quite a bit. That's why I find that such an interesting subject. but, you know, bring somebody else into this conversation, and he would start talk, or she would start talking about painting or needlework or gymnastics or goodness knows what, sport. I mean, that's another one, isn't it? A huge subject. Competitive sport is clearly part of human nature in some sense, especially masculine nature. I mean, I know men who don't give a toss about Premier League football, but I know a great many more men who are irrationally obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And the same point applies to them. They don't need to feel bad about this, because that's the kind of animal we are.
In that it can accept differences.
Well, in that we like competition. We
like, I see what you mean. Right, okay. Right.
If not warfare, then something that's very like warfare. I mean, cricket, my particular obsession.
Medieval
jousting. You've got a missile coming at you, and you've got a sword in your hand made of wood. I mean, it is pretty close to warfare. And that appeals to something deep in human nature. And it's not surprising, is it?
No. And early forms of football, and the Kenneth Branagh version of Henry V.
Yes.
The battle scene seemed very similar.
And of course, drama and literature and all that. It's all... personally, I think that one of the ways that humans make use of art to get useful things done is that art is a very good way to have a conversation with a stranger without being intrusive. I still remember with enormous pleasure a discussion I had at a party about 7 or 8 years ago now with an Indian. And instead of the old cliche question of, you know, where are you from and all that, which is a bit insulting, especially if the answer's Croydon, you know. I can't remember how I'd learned it. I think somebody else was talking about some film they'd seen, and it emerged that he and I shared a love of Shakespeare, and we had a big conversation about that. And it was a deeply satisfying conversation because it was both full of deep feeling but also deeply unintrusive. I wasn't asking him about his children or his country of origin or whatever other insulting racist thing I could have said. Instead, we were agreeing about that marvelous scene in Henry IV Part 1 or whatever it was, you know. And therefore, art, literature, conversationally, is rather like a hymn in a church. It binds people together. It introduces people to each other. And sport does the same, doesn't it? For men in pubs, you know, they're able to discuss strong emotions about the jiggle of some Welsh fly half as he eludes the opposition back row and scores a superb try under the posts. I mean, oh, look at that. What a feeling. What a exquisite moment. I mean, you must have conversations like this with your Watford
all the time,
fan friends.
All the time. Oh, yes. And fans of other teams as well.
Yes, that's important as well.
There's a whole range of controversies and things, but they're not sort of religious controversies so much. I mean, yes, there's that basic religious element that you support a certain team. But
when I'm saying religion, I'm meaning binding of society together, which is a useful thing to do. That getting a team spirit in human affairs, because when you get it, you get a lot done, don't you?
Is that right? Certainly in a war you do.
I think so.
In other contexts? I mean, maybe it's with humans. It's war is the big thing. It's the war. It's what we're designed to do primarily. Because if you get war wrong, my goodness, it could be a disaster.
Well, yes, but also people often use military metaphors to describe peaceful activities. You know, we've got to fight against this and we've got to...
The war on drugs, for instance.
Yes, war on drugs and... And people in companies need to have a certain esprit de corps, don't they? I mean, maybe I'm romanticising business, but I think that there's some truth in that idea, isn't there? I mean, something like running a good railway involves creating a sense of almost militaristic team playing among the staff. And think of how transport uniforms mimic military uniforms to create the same feeling.
Well, one of the reasons for that is so the members of the public can recognise the members of staff, I suspect. I mean, for instance, a steam engine driver tended not to wear a uniform. perhaps because it was so obvious what he was doing, but
because a station he never master actually met the public very much.
Yeah,
yes.
Or a station master or a clippy would.
Yeah, so, that's a good point.
Yeah, I always wonder why I wear a uniform as a security guard. That's why, so people know what my function is.
Yes, yes. Well, the way I'm talking about these things reflects the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, the best explanation for why human life is what it is contained in books like this one.
Yes. It's genetics and evolution and that stuff.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That stuff. Exactly. And as I say, this feeling has become stronger as I've got old and approached death and closer than I, and sooner than I wanted to, but in no way has it diminished, quite the opposite.
No. I wonder if being in that proverbial foxhole would be slightly different, because it's...
I'm sure it is.
Death
it's
is
much more intense,
a little bit more imminent.
Much more physically scary, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, and I remain curious about what my state of mind will be when I really am, in medically speaking, in the foxhole. I'm expecting to live, if I'm lucky, for the next few hours rather than the next few months or years, which is what the position I'm in now. Yeah. So, yes, I'll be interested to see if I have any disposition to believe in God in my final moments.
Well, do tell us.
Well, I'm,
sorry,
I may,
I'm
not
being...
may not be able to.
Yes, no, I just think that's a really silly thing to say.
Well, no.
Well, I mean, there's that scene in Brideshead Revisited, isn't there? Where
remind me, I don't know this one.
The what's his name?
I know the book,
Laurence Olivier
but
character. He's born a Catholic, been a lapsed Catholic for decades, comes back to Brideshead to die, and in the last 30 seconds of his life, clearly becomes a Catholic again.
Yes, yes. Well, I was.
Of course,
I was
that's
raised
fiction.
By...
Fiction. We should
yes.
remember.
Well, yes, but fiction. You know, we're talking reality as well, aren't we? I was raised by Church of England atheists, so I expect to die a Church of England atheist myself. In other words, you go back to the very core of what you were taught as a little baby, and it took me a while to work it out. But my parents were both atheists, actually. My father kept quiet about it, and my mother regarded Christianity as very bizarre and strange, and often pornographic, her word. So that's probably my basic feeling about Christianity. I do love it in a musical sort of way. I love the words of things like the marriage ceremony and the burial service and things like that.
I thought you were going to say the hymns. Dearly I like the hymns. I think they're pretty good.
Yes, I like the hymns. Yes, yeah. Indeed. And, of course, all the classical music that sets this stuff to music, you know.
Yeah.
So the music of religion, I both in the literal sense and in the metaphorical sense, I love. But the fundamental beliefs of it, no, I just can't take them. And as you've said to me many times, just can't be doing with it.
Yeah. I suspect we're straying off the subject.
Well, I'm not averse to that, because this book has been reviewed by millions of people, lots of people. I wasn't interested in doing just another review. I wanted to have a conversation provoked by the book rather than just a discussion about the book itself. And that's what we've had.
We have indeed.
Shall we end it there, do you think?
Well, there was something I wanted to... you about, but this might take a long time because it involves modern architecture, and
yes.
I know what your views on modern architecture are. And then this comes from the Breton fishing boat thing.
Yes,
and because the point there was that it applies to fishing boats around the world, by the way, but it's just someone. Gave that
it was
example,
spotted
originally.
By a French philosopher, yeah. And he was in Brittany at the time that he observed this phenomenon. Yes, or thought he did.
But the point was that you know, bad boats sank and good boats came back. So the good boats got copied, and that's how the Breton fishing boats developed. A form of natural selection, in fact.
Precisely.
And you were sort of saying that. I think Steve Stewart Williams is saying this, copying is a good thing, copying is an essential thing, copying is a sensible thing to do.
Yes, yes. And one of my beefs against Modern architecture means two distinct things. One is it means the kind of modern building techniques that evolved first in Chicago and New York to build skyscrapers, which I've no problem with at all. But then what happened was that Europeans looked at all this and then cooked up their own highly idiosyncratic version of what it all ought to consist of. And that's where the modern movement in architecture comes from.
And this is the idea that you design from first principles.
Yeah, there are many ideas in architectural modernism that strike me as over the top, mistaken. But the worst one of all, one of the very worst, is the idea that when you confront a design problem, you go back to first principles, whatever the hell those are supposed to be, instead of saying, well, how was it done last time around?
This is Ayn Rand's form as
Rand
function.
Rand is deeply wrong about architecture in this kind of way, in my opinion. It's a misunderstanding of rationalism. The man to read on this is Hayek.
Right. Where and what does he say?
Well, he talks about the way that free people follow conventions. There's a scene where he describes it coming to England for the first time from Austria and reflecting on the puzzle of how the English seem to be both very liberal and individualistic, at the same time highly conformist. What's going on? The answer is they were choosing to be conformist. Conformism was a personal technique of living. They weren't being compelled to be conformist. They just were choosing to be. And he understood that this was actually very wise.
And the relationship with that and architecture is...
Well, the sort of thing that Hayek had in mind was the Bloomsbury morality, which said that if you couldn't explain why conventional morality, in sneer quotes, was a good thing, then you should abandon it. Well, people who abandon conventional ideas about, for example, marital fidelity, run into trouble, let's put it that way. In ways they perhaps were not expecting, as well as ways they might have expected. And that's the sort of idea that Hayek had in mind, that following the way things are done is not at all a bad way to live in the absence of any strong views along other lines. And I'm particularly interested in the application of that Hayekian attitude to design. If you're designing a house, your default position ought to be, what are the other houses like? Which of them are good? Which of them work? Let's copy that. But that is anathema to the modernists, or was when the modern movement first arrived.
Can you give some examples of bad modern buildings? I'm sure you can, but
the early tower blocks. The early concrete tower blocks.
And I know this might just sound like a really, really dumb question, but stupid questions are always worth asking. But what was bad about them?
Well, I'll tell you the worst thing about them, and that was not what happened inside the building necessarily, or what the building itself consisted of, but what happened at ground level. In my opinion, the most destructive effects of architectural modernism are seen at ground level rather than up in the sky.
They are?
Well, yes.
If you can hear something in the background, it's hail.
Oh, is it? I thought it was you typing notes. That's interesting.
Right.
Well, never mind. What I mean by that is that the architectural modernists in Europe were vitriolically hostile to what they described as higgledy-piggledy streets and muddle, the muddle of street. The whole idea of a street is something they literally declared war on. They rethought the grammar of the city and turned it from lots and lots of thoroughfares with buildings next to it into something quite different. They separated the buildings from the roads, turned them into completely distinct arenas, and this was disastrous, utterly disastrous. The only good thing you can say about it is that it's relatively easy to correct.
In what way was it disastrous?
Well, it created dead areas. and very unsafe areas. I mean, it was an absolute bonanza for petty criminals, mm-hmm. this.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the best books on this is, I didn't expect to be talking about this, it was a book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs, in which she spent a lot of time explaining how, well, first of all, hers is one of the best books you can still read about this whole episode of modernism being smashed on top of conventional urban design in a most brutal way. Fully comparable with the attentions of the Luftwaffe.
I mean, it sounds as if your complaint is not actually the buildings themselves. It's a more of a...
Well, the buildings themselves were pretty bad. I mean, if you one of the problems if you work from first principles is that you have to rethink absolutely everything. And you fail to rethink absolutely everything successfully. And so you have the absurdity. My favourite example is that they actually built a major big city hospital. I can't remember where it was. I think it was somewhere in America, where the beds did not fit into the lifts.
That's pretty bad, yes.
I mean, that's pretty basic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And another one was perpetrated by an idiot relative of mine called Bosanquet, which is my mother's maiden name. He designed some houses in a housing estate in a new town. And being an architect of that particular vintage, he said, "Well, look at your average house. How silly! Why does it have that pointy roof on top? How stupid! We can get rid of that." So he made a much flatter roof, not completely flat, but it was very shallow slope in both directions. So there was in effect no attic. And then another thing he looked at was the way that the roof. I'm not making this up, by the way. This is a real story. He then looked at the way the roof was attached to the walls of the house, you know, as a join at the top of the walls. And previously, there'd been an actual, you know, a fixture which made it stick. But he said, "Oh, we don't need that. That's, oh, you know."
I think I'm going to see what's happening now.
What you've done is put an aeroplane wing unattached on top of a wall. So guess what happened in the first high wind?
The roofs blew off.
And this is somebody who's paid not to make mistakes like that. And he makes them because of the way he's thinking.
But, how are we... I mean, you know, not all traditions are good ones, I'd argue.
No.
I mean, we do have to make progress.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. Where I differ from conservatives about design is that they talk about traditional designs as if they're perfect and we just need to carry on doing it. But the whole point of architectural modernity in the first place, as opposed to the modern movement, is that there was a real problem to be solved. Namely, how the hell do you accommodate all these pen pushers in a city like Chicago as near to each other as they all want to be to get their work done? I mean, the demand for office space in Chicago was explosive. And it couldn't be accommodated in conventional urban buildings with 6 or 7 stories, which was the limit of how high they could go with conventional materials. So they invented a whole new form of building in the form of a skyscraper, which is made of steel and concrete, especially steel. And for all that that was a rethink, a radical rethink, it was a radical rethink worth doing. And they were right to attempt to build skyscrapers and make them work, despite all the problems and difficulties that they had to overcome to make them work.
I've just got this half thought of a possible justification for the modern architects, because they would have been working in the shadow of the Second World War when a lot of houses were destroyed. And maybe
they
saw the same thing.
Well,
look, we have got to house a lot of people quickly.
Yeah, but they destroyed lots of houses after the war as well.
Yeah, that's true.
They had a
real
venom towards conventional housing. You know, these suburbs, they hated suburbs. They really did.
Yeah.
It's not an exaggeration. These people wrote fulminating rants against what we now think of as nice places to live. I mean, there's a famous story of somebody going to a town in the north and going into the local newspaper shop with a queue of people and everything and saying, you know, quite politely and friendly way, "I'm visiting this town." And then he said, "Isn't it terrible what the Nazis did to this place?" And the answer he got from the people in the shop was, That wasn't the fucking Nazis. That was the fucking architects. They were the ones who destroyed the town.
Maybe it's not the architects as such. Maybe it's the planners. We've got to.
Well, they're the same people.
Right. Okay.
That's a big, big pretense by the architectural profession that they had nothing to do with it. Oh, no, it was the planners. Rubbish. They were absolutely up to their necks in this story. I know. I was trained by these people when I studied architecture. If I have a bit of an animus towards them, it's because I'm a failed architect. That might be part of it. But the reason I failed...
Well, I think our animus is shared by a lot of non-architects, so I think you...
Well, exactly. I failed to be an architect. I'm very clear why I failed. It's because I couldn't handle the detail. It wasn't because I disagreed with these people, and I have been a fan of architecture ever since. And one of the things I've noticed is that modernism in architecture, especially in a city like London, began as a catalogue of catastrophe and ugliness and sheer failure and criminality and stupidity of every imaginable sort, but it has improved radically. And I do not share the contempt felt by the Prince Charles tendency, so to speak, for modern skyscrapers built by the private sector. You know, the Shard, the Gherkin. I love all that stuff.
Thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
Yes. If it was easier to pronounce, that would be a very common phrase, wouldn't it?
Certainly by me.
Absolutely. But what's happened is that, you see, there are now modern architecture practices. There have been for 20 years now, where the word got round among the developers. When these guys build a building, it stays up. It works. It doesn't leak. The roof doesn't cave in. It's not an ugly shithole. People like it. And those were the ones who got the work.
Yeah.
And the way they work, when these people are designing a new bunch of medium-sized skyscrapers in London, some kid fresh out of college is designing it, and some older geezer comes over and looks at what he's doing and says, "Ah, no, that's not the way we do these things." In other words, follow the tradition, the sort of little tradition that we've developed since the 1960s, of how to make these things work.
This starts with the skyscraper. Has there been any similar development in the last 100 years?
Which I don't think there's anything quite as dramatic as that.
No.
Certainly bridges have come on a lot, but they were never prized out of the hands of structural engineers, i.e. the people who knew how you built bridges and how they didn't fall down. I think international airports, perhaps, almost, and football stadiums, sports stadiums in general, are a very striking new development. Although, only in the sense that there's now lots more of them. They're used to, after all, the Colosseum in ancient Rome is what they're all based on, isn't it?
I suppose so, yes.
But I can't think of any other building quite as striking as, building type, as striking as the skyscraper.
I mean, I could mention, which is, of course, after the war, a lot of people ended up in prefabs. Which had a certain reputation, as I understand it.
Well, I think there was a kind of logic to that that was lacking in the 60s abominations, which is that literally lots of people didn't have any houses at all and they needed them quick.
Yeah.
I mean, I slept in a prefab at my school because... when I arrived at my senior house, Littlefield, in Marlborough College, Marlborough Wilts, the house had been burnt down, and we slept in huts during the early part of the year 1963.
The famous winter
does
of 63.
Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, it does. It's before my
the
time.
Big freeze.
Yeah, people would talk about that for years afterwards. So.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean,
to the extent that I was talking about it yesterday to someone.
Yes.
So, yes, it's still part of the culture.
Yeah, well, we lived in huts. God, never forgotten that. I had a hot water bottle, which, when I arrived, was greeted with scorn. But a week later, people were begging to hire it from me, and I kept it. And one night, in the morning, after I was still in my bed, but it had icicles in it. That's how cold it was.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, let me put it this way. I mean, I occasionally cycle to work or from work in the morning in winter, and it has to be something like -4 before the water bottle will start to ice up.
Yes.
So that's the sort of temperatures you're...
That's cold, is yes, what I'm is, saying.
Yes,
yes,
very cold.
Yeah. But we've sort of gone hurtling off on a tangent.
We have.
But it's rooted in the notion that the way to do culture is to, as it were, go with the flow of cultural evolution. That is to say, to do what genes do and copy, you know, replicate.
But follow sometimes,
the rules unless you really
actually,
know what
work.
You're doing. Yeah, but sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes the conventions just lead you into a blind alley and you have to do something radical to get out of it. And that's my favorite. The skyscraper is one of my favorite examples of it. Another one, by the way, which I think is excellent, is the very first steamships. I think we may have mentioned this in an earlier conversation, but the Great Western or Eastern, which was it?
The Brunel, Western was the first.
The first one.
Yeah.
The point is, it was very, very big.
Oh, that's the Great Eastern. The Great Eastern's problem was it was very, very big, yes.
Well, the first one was very big because it had to be.
It did?
There was no point in building a small metal steamship because then the coal needed to propel it would have taken up the entire ship and it wouldn't have been any good to transport people and stuff. And the bigger you make the ship, the more space there is then for a load, besides the load of fuel that you have to carry with you.
I think we'll have to check up on this, because my understanding of the chronology is that it started with the Great Western, which got across the Atlantic. You then have the SS Great Britain, and then you have the Great Eastern, and they're getting bigger. Each one is bigger than the predecessor.
Yes.
And I think I'm also right in saying that I know the SS Britain... Great Britain wasn't a great success. I know the Great Eastern wasn't a great success. And I'm pretty sure the Great Western was not the first over the...
But Patrick, that's because radical rethinking is very dangerous. I mean, you get problems you didn't see coming.
Yeah.
That's its nature. That's not surprising that these ships should have been a problem. The point is, Brunel was not an idiot. He was doing something that made absolute sense. And even though it was extremely difficult to do, it was still worth doing. That's the point. There's no point in building a small metal ship. It's a waste of time.
Ah, right. I see.
It's a waste of space, is what it is. You end up with an object. Well, and of course, none of this applies to the age of diesel fuel that came later, I don't think. It was particularly pertinent when ships were powered by coal.
Mm-hmm.
Because coal takes up a lot of space.
I mean, the point being is, you know, 50 years later, everything is steel or iron. Everything is fueled by coal.
Everything big. I mean, you still get wooden yachts and, you know,
a few
for tourists.
I'm sure you got a few clippers as well.
Around.
You know, in 1910, but not many. That
coal-powered
steam was the way to go.
And you know, you were asking, is there anything else as remarkable as the story of the skyscraper in architecture? Well, probably not in architecture, but in other things, yes. Things like the jet airliner and the non-sailing but big ship are very striking and very modern, aren't they? There's nothing remotely like it in the past. I mean, these latest cruise ships are absolutely gigantic.
Yeah.
And there's probably a similar economic point that the bigger you make a cruise ship, the more money you make from the people who travel on it.
Yeah.
It's got to be. You look at these things, they're absolutely monsters, aren't they?
Yes.
And there must be all sorts of problems associated with scaling up a passenger ship in that elephantine fashion. But those problems are worth getting to grips with and worth learning about and worth discovering solutions to. And that, as I say,
I mean, they strike me as more evolutionary than revolutionary. I mean, the cruise ships.
Well, once you've made the first leap that Brunel made, yes.
Yeah.
Everything since then is evolution. But that's the point. That's the pattern I also see with the modern movement architecture of a place like London. That it starts with the people who built the concrete monstrosity estates were fabricating problems and unleashing non-solutions upon them in a very, very destructive and belligerent manner. I mean, there was an amazing TV show done by somebody on British TV where he said a lot of this stuff came from gun emplacements during the war. The brutalist style of architecture came from copying, bunkers that the Nazis had built to defend the Normandy coasts against invasion. In other words, they're military buildings.
I think the German emplacements.
Why do people hate brutalism? Well, he might have a clue in that, you know.
The Nazi gun emplacements I've seen are a lot more aesthetically pleasing than, say, the National Theatre or Gallery.
They do have a certain style to them, don't they?
Yeah.
But the influence is very clear. But the other thing is that aesthetically the modernists did have a sort of point, I think, which is that decoration in the 19th century was a real problem because although you had machines that could thrash it out on an unlimited scale, in terms of the meaning of the decoration, that was the problem. It ceased to be one-off. Well, you want to see the work. There's a sort of labour theory of value that applies to decoration, isn't there? And if it's just thrashed out by a machine, it kind of loses its meaning.
I still like it, even if it is thrashed out by a machine, personally. But
I'm with you there. I saw a building yesterday which was it was in a style I refer to as fake ancient, and it was so well done that I swear most of the people who drive past it would think it was real ancient. It's in the Fulham Road. It's a little gated housing estate, and it looked so like a medieval piece of brickwork, but it wasn't. It was built in 1980 something. Extraordinary.
Right.
I took lots of photos, and I'm intending to put some of them up on my personal blog.
I wonder, there was an architecture who went across against the grain in the 80s, wasn't there? Who did a lot of this sort of stuff. I wonder if it's one of his.
Quinlan Terry?
Yes.
Yes. Well, there are quite a lot of firms like that on the quiet operating. Because of my internet activity, I get adverts for such things quite often. And there's a new town somebody's building in Southampton, the whole point of which is that it looks like an e-oldie town. There's a lot of pushback against modernism, especially outside London.
Well, are there any true modernists left?
Outside London? Yes, a few, not very many.
Okay.
But, I mean, arguably there are no true modernists left because they're now much more traditional than they were 50 years ago. They're much more cautious about innovation and much more ready to do it the way we do it, you know.
Yeah, so they've actually copied themselves in essence and fixed the mistakes they were making.
Yes. I mean, it's not quite that a building sinks without trace and kills everybody in it if it's a failure, but it's not unlike that in the impact. You know, if a tower block collapses, it's a pretty catastrophic event for the people living in it, and definitely for the architect.
Yes.
And, I mean, one of the obvious things you can say in favour of higgledy-piggledy housing estates is that if one of the houses malfunctions, you don't have to rip the whole damn lot down and start again.
Although if it's an estate, of course, and they've all been built the same way. Like we did in the 19th century, of course.
You
have all these terrace houses. Whereas if it's
but all of this is a conversation resting inverted pyramid style on top of those Breton fishing boats. And I do recommend a read of that blog posting I did about it. If you can put that in the notes.
Yeah.
It's a lovely piece. That's stolen from Steve Stewart Williams's book, copied. You know, you're not supposed to copy little bits from books onto blogs, but I've been doing it for years and I've never had a publisher complain. Mostly because they just had no idea it was happening. But you can bet the author will have picked up on some of these things. And the authors, on the quiet, quite like it. Because there's no better way to sell a book than to read a chunk from it, if it's a good book.
No, quite.
And there are quite a few chunks of this book to be read on my blog.
There are. I'll try to get all the links up as best I can.
You just get some of them. I mean, if you type Steve Stewart Williams into the search bit of my blog, it'll all come up, so you'll see it.
Right.
It's no big problem.
Are we done?
I am. Are you? Are there any other things you want to say about this?
I think so. I wanted to have that chat about architecture and what disasters.
Well, perhaps one final thing I'll say is I did a piece called Design as Outcome, which I think it's the piece of writing I did a long time ago now, 30 years ago, I think, where I dealt with these sorts of themes.
Yeah, you did. It's up on the Brian Micklethwaite Archive.
Is it now there? Good.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, well,
that
yeah. That's good.
Very good. Yeah, very enjoyable piece
well,
of writing.
That's the only extra thing I want to say. So, but this book is a very good one.
Yes,
the Ape That Understood the Universe. If you want to know,
we finally mentioned the name, right?
Well, we have mentioned it before. No, I think I did mention that before.
Okay,
but it's a very good book, and there are lots of things in it that I haven't even mentioned. Like, for example, the way he introduces it with an alien describing humans in a rather confused fashion and being puzzled by what on earth human culture consists of. So that's quite entertaining. He's a fine popularizer. He's trying to get students wound up about all this stuff and having fun and get them to talk about it amongst themselves. And I think it succeeds. It's a very good book in that way.
Excellent.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.